Chevalier reasonably concluded that Oppenheimer's denial also meant to warn him that he could face a libel suit if he wrote that Oppenheimer had joined the Communist Party. So the following year, he published Oppenheimer, The Story of a Friendship, without the bald allegation. Instead, throughout the book, the alleged CP closed unit is described merely as a discussion group. Chevalier told Oppenheimer that he had been compelled to write this book because history, though coy, needs truth to be her handmaiden. But in this case, the truth lies in each man's perception. Were all members of the Berkeley discussion group also members of the CP? Apparently, Chevalier believed they were. Oppenheimer insisted that he, at least, was not. He would fund specific causes through the CP, the Spanish Republic, farm workers, civil rights, and consumer protection. He would attend meetings, offer his advice, and even help the party's intellectuals write position papers. But he did not have a party card. He did not pay dues. He was totally free of party discipline. His friends might have had reasons to think he was a comrade, but it was clear to him that he was not. John Earl Haynes and Harvey Clare, two historians of American communism, have written that to be a communist was to be part of a rigid mental world tightly sealed from outside influences. This certainly does not describe Robert Oppenheimer at any time. He was reading Marx, but he was also reading the Bhagavad Gita, Ernest Hemingway, and Sigmund Freud, and, in those years, the last was grounds for expulsion from the party. In short, Oppenheimer never entered into that peculiar social contract expected of party members. Robert was probably closer to the party in the 1930s than he later admitted or even remembered, but he was not nearly as close to it as his friend Hoken believed. This is neither surprising nor deceitful. The so-called secret units of the party, the sort of association that Oppenheimer is alleged to have had, were organizations without formal rosters or established rules and with little, if any, regimentation, as Chevalier explained to Martin Sherwin. For obvious organizational reasons, the party chose to see those individuals associated with secret units as having made substantial personal commitments. On the other hand, each committed member could set the limits of his commitment, and that commitment could change over time, even very short periods of time, as it did, for instance, with Jean Tatlock. Chevalier seemed always to be committed to the party, and in those days when he and Robert were close friends, it is not surprising that he considered Robert equally committed. Perhaps for a time he was, but we do not, and we cannot, know the extent of his commitment. But what we can say with confidence is that Robert's period of high commitment was short and did not last. The bottom line is that Robert always wished to be, and was, free to think for himself and to make his own political choices. Commitments have to be put in perspective to be understood, and the failure to do that was the most damaging characteristic of the McCarthy period. The most relevant political fact about Robert Oppenheimer was that in the 1930s he was devoted to working for social and economic justice in America, and to achieve this goal he chose to stand with the left.